If you'd go in your Bibles, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 14. We've been in several different places recently. Before my missions trip to Togo, at the beginning of November, we were looking at the book of John. Since then, we've been in several different places. And we're going to be launching, as Mike said, into a series on the revelation of God. This is not disconnected from it. But it doesn't specifically point to Jesus in the way that those others will with regard to Advent. But it prepares us in order to look at Jesus and why we need to look at Jesus. So 1 Samuel 14 is the story in the middle of the fall of Saul and the rise of David. In chapter 13, Saul has failed, and he's failed in a large way. He's gotten scared as the enemy has surrounded him, as his men are running away, and so he takes and sacrifices. He fulfills the priestly office as the king, and he's not allowed to do that. But he wanted to get God's blessing on him, on his people, on his agenda. And because he disobeyed God and disobeyed God's word, Samuel said, "You will be rejected as king." He said, God has chosen a man after his own heart." So we don't know yet that it's going to be David. We just know it's going to be somebody other than Saul. And it's because Saul's heart is not right before God. Well, chapter 14 comes and we get the story of Jonathan. And Jonathan is the king's son. And Jonathan has a different heart than his dad. Rather than sitting back, he takes the offensive. He launches out and he begins to do what a king is supposed to do. And we're like, is this the guy? I mean, like, dynasty done, but heir to the throne, heir apparent. What's going on here? And so we're wondering what's going on. We're going to actually read the story as it unfolds through the sermon here. But I want you to see, as we're looking at this, Jonathan acts the way he acts because he sees God one way. On the other side of the coin, the other main character in this story is Saul. And Saul acts the way he acts because he sees God an entirely different way. Same God, different lenses, a different perspective on the God that they're viewing. Well, Al Mohler cited an interesting article this week. The article begins, "A majority of young Americans from a variety of faiths and no faith say that they've experienced a sacred moment." Now, if you don't know what a sacred moment is, just a minute, we'll get there. According to the new survey, but their definitions of what is sacred may not line up with those of their parents or grandparents. So Springtide Research's Institute, the report entitled "The State of Religion in Young People in 2023, in Exploring the Sacred," pushes back on the notion that Generation Z exhibits a simple disinterest in matters of the divine or the spiritual. In fact, some 55% of the more than 4,500 people ages 13 to 25 who were surveyed told the researchers that they've discovered what Springtide called experiences that evoked a sense of wonder, awe, gratitude, deep truth, and or interconnectedness in life. The sacred. Do you believe in the sacred? Have you ever had a sacred moment? And by that, they mean, have you ever had a sense of wonder? Yeah, like every time the teacher said there was going to be a test. Like, okay. Have you ever experienced awe, gratitude, deep truth, interconnectedness in your life? So that phrase, their definitions of what's sacred might not line up with those of their grandparents. So how is it that earlier generations spoke of knowing God? How did they talk about the sacred moments in life? One of my favorite quotes is from A.W. Tozer. He writes a short book called Knowledge of the Holy. But what he says is really profound. It's a short book, but it's a profound book. It's a deep and heavy book. He says, what comes into our minds when we think about God is the most important thing about us. Worship is pure or it is base, as the worshiper entertains either high or low thoughts about God. For this reason, the gravest question before the church is always God himself. And the most pretentious fact about any man is not what he at any given time may say or do, but what he in his deep heart conceives God to be like. Who is God? How do you understand God? Who do you see God to be? What do you think of when you think God? That is to say, our lives will reveal the God that we worship. You can't get away from it. Your life will reveal what God looks like in your life. We saw that last week in Psalm 135, right? The psalmist says, the idols of the nations are silver and gold. They're the work of human hands. They have mouths, but they don't speak. They have eyes, but they can't see. They have ears, but they don't hear. There's no breath. There's no spirit in their mouth. No spirit of the gods in their mouths. And those who make them become like them, so also do all who trust in them. You become like what you worship. It's not just a nice saying. It's true. Your life will reveal what God looks like to you. The God of the Bible is a self-revealing God, and he's told us who he is. He's informed us what he likes. And any so-called God that we construct of our own imagination, even somehow moved by this image that we construct, will eventually prove to align our lives with this self-revealed God, or will not align our lives with it. It is in fact true that you are what you worship, or at least you become like what you worship. But A.W. Tozer keeps writing, and what he says is even more profound than what he said already. He says, we tend by a secret law of the soul to move toward our mental image of our God. And this is true not only of individual Christians, but of the company of Christians that composes the church. Always the most revealing thing about the church is her idea or her conception of God, just as her most significant message is what she says about him or leaves unsaid, for her silence is often more eloquent than her speech. As we take time today to transition between holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, we also come to a significant moment in our church calendar. It's our annual business meeting today. It's that time of year when we look ourselves in the mirror and we examine just what it is that we really are as a group of believers, how we measure up to what we say we'd like to be. The question before us today is this. It's before each of us individually. It's before all of us corporately. What God do we worship? What God do we worship? Or maybe a more pointed way of asking the same question is who is God to you? Now, not that we don't know who God is, right? But who do you know God is? How has God infiltrated your thinking? How has God infiltrated your feeling? How has God infiltrated not just your actions, but your reactions? Who do you know God to be? Who is God to you? I'm not asking this in a relativistic kind of way. Your God is this, your God is that. That's not what I'm saying. This is the God that we're called to know. My question is this. Do you know this God? Do you know him by experience? Have you tasted and seen that he is good? The answer to that question won't just be an articulation of your understanding of Orthodox doctrine. In fact, your answer to that question won't even be articulated most accurately by you. We think we know what we know about God. But your answer to that question is being answered every day in the choices that you make. It's being answered in the things that you love, in the things that you hate, in the things that you fear, in the things that you retreat to from this broken world in order to find comfort. Your answer to that question is best known and answered by those around you. Those who see how you do life and see how you do life every day. Because you live life in light of your God. So my proposition is rather simple this morning. It's let the one true God, the only true God, shape the realities of your daily life. As we come into this Christmas season, that's my challenge. Let the one true God shape the contours, shape the perspectives, shape what is real in your life, not just at Christmas time, but every day. That means it has to be every moment of every day. Our text this morning is going to give us two competing visions of this one true God. We're not talking God and Baal. We're not talking God and Molech. We're not talking God and Shamash. We're talking Yahweh or Yahweh, but two different visions of Yahweh, of the one true God of the Bible. So what are these competing visions? Well, in order to understand where this text falls, we have to understand its context. In chapter 13, back in verse 3, Jonathan has defeated the garrison of the Philistines. Saul took 2,000 men, Jonathan took 1,000 men, and Saul sat with twice the army and said, "What are we going to do?" And Jonathan said, "Hey guys, we only got half the army, but let's go see what we got." And he takes him and he defeats the garrison of the Philistines. Saul says, "You know what? That's my son, king's son. We're claiming victory over this, okay? Saul has defeated the garrison." And that's encouraging. I mean, yes, it's like we sent in the Navy SEALs, but U.S. Army, we claim the victory, right? It was the U.S. We get the credit. So it's, but it just kind of makes you scratch your head. Wait a minute. Jonathan defeated the garrisons, but go to chapter 13, verse 3. "So Saul blew the trumpet throughout all the land and says, 'Let the Hebrews hear.' And all Israel heard it, said that Saul had defeated the garrison of the Philistines." And you're supposed to question, you're supposed to kind of scratch your head and say, "Well, wait a minute. Is Saul just like saying, 'Hey, our team won, like Israel defeated?'" No. That's not "Go USA." That's like chest-thumping daddy, just a little bit jealous of his son who took some initiative. Ah, is that what's happening? And you're supposed to have that taste in your mouth at this point. And so this renown of Saul goes out. Everybody's excited. They gather this army. And then, verse 5, the Philistines muster to fight with Israel. 30,000 chariots. Again, this is really hilly country, so they're not going to really be that effective, but it looks really good sitting on top of a hill. Okay, 30,000 chariots. And 6,000 horsemen and troops, 6,000 horsemen and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. He's setting this up on purpose. He wants us to get a size of this army in our minds. He's used this phrase before. He's used this language before. The biblical author. Well, we don't know exactly who wrote 1 Samuel, but it reflects the language of biblical authors in the past. The last time we've seen an army the size of the sand of the seashore is back in Joshua. I mean, it's really a strategic campaign as Joshua is pressing north to take the top part of the promised land. And we've got this whole army spread out, as many as the sands of the seashore. And Joshua says, "Let's go." And they go, and God defeats them. There was one other time in the book of Judges when Gideon goes to the Midianites, and they're all gathered around, and he's got 300 guys at the time. And it has God setting it up in the story. It says, and they had troops like the sands of the seashore. It's like, wow. And Gideon blows the trumpet, cracks the pitchers, They're all on different sides. It looks like there's seven different armies coming, and the guys don't know which way to go, so they turn and they cut each other down in order to get away, and they all kill each other. And so as we start to read this, we're like, whoa, bad day. But what's God going to do? So we're excited. Jonathan just got a victory. Israel's getting the credit. And now we've got this bad guys, good guys, not a real good setup. And all of a sudden we see Saul, the king, step into action. Verse 6 of chapter 13. When the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, they were pressed hard. The people hid themselves in caves and holes and rocks and tombs and cisterns. Some of the Hebrews crossed the fords of the Jordan to get to the other side, run away. All the people followed anybody who was left that followed Saul with trembling. Like, go king, you're the big guy, right? You're head and shoulders above everybody else. We're behind you. The way the little brother's behind the big brother is they're going down the hall in the dark with a candle. I'm behind you. Okay. Verse 8, Saul waited for 7 days, the time that appointed by Samuel. But Samuel didn't show up in time. Everybody's running away. So Saul said, bring the burnt offering to me. Bring the peace offerings. And he offered the burnt offering. And as soon as he finished, Samuel showed up. Why did Saul do what he's doing? Well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? I mean, we've got the enemy, and we're outnumbered. We started with 3,000. Now everybody's running away. We don't have that many anymore. In fact, before it's all said and done, verse 15, the middle of the verse, Saul numbered the people who were present with him. At this point, there are about 600 men. This is a bad day. So he's afraid. People are scattering. Samuel's not coming. The Philistines are there. And the circumstances say, I've got to do something. And so he takes matters into his own hands. So what does he do? He makes the offering. He does what he's not supposed to do. He acts like a priest when he's only a king. Well, are we just kind of shooting at semantics here? We're not. Because who is the king of Israel? Saul. Well, yes, but no. The king of Israel is God. Okay? And any other king is an underling king. And actually, the priest has as much access to God and even more than the king. The prophet has more authority than the king because the prophet speaks the very word of God. And so Saul messes everything up. He messes up the picture. He messes up the authority. He messes up all of his leadership potential because he says, hey, it's all about me. I'm the guy. I've got to make things happen. I'm the linchpin here. God says, no, you're not. You're just a tool. You're just my servant. I'm the king. I've got this. And because you want that glory for yourself, and because you won't wait, you won't operate by my rules, because you won't lead my people in worship and obedience and trust and faith, I'm going to find somebody else. And so he says, Samuel says to him in verse 13, you've done foolishly. You've not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. If you had, he would have established your kingdom forever. But now your kingdom will not continue. Instead, the Lord has sought out a man after his own heart, and the Lord has commanded him to be prince over his people because you've not kept the command that the Lord has given. So Saul's rejected. Samuel leaves. There's now no word from God left in the camp. What are we going to do? Prophet's gone. King still has the responsibility. We're still faced with an army. And we're told about the superiority of this Philistine army. End of chapter 13 says, oh, by the way, there's two swords in all of Israel. One belongs to Saul, one belongs to Jonathan. The rest of them don't have any because the only iron in the place belongs to the Philistines, and the only blacksmiths are in Philistine territory. In fact, if you wanted to get your plow sharpened, if you wanted to get your axe sharpened, you had to go down into the valley to go to the Philistines in order to get that taken care of. You've got a Philistine army armed with horsemen, bows, arrows, swords, shields, spears, everything they need, and you've got 600 men with two swords. This is supposed to look bad because it is, okay? That's the context that we come to when Jonathan, chapter 14, verse 1. So one day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, "Hey, how about you and me come, both of us together, let's go over to the Philistine garrison to the other side." But he didn't tell his father. Saul was staying in the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave or underneath the pomegranate tree at Migron, and the people who were with him were about 600 men, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub, Ichabod's brother, son of Phinehas, son of Eli, the priest of the Lord, and Shiloh. That's not a throwaway phrase. All of that's there on purpose. This priest was wearing the ephod. So maybe we will still have a word from the Lord. The people didn't know that Jonathan had gone. Within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine, he sought to go over. He's looking for an opportunity to go. But in this way, there was a rocky crag on the one side, a rocky crag on the other side. The name of the one was Bozez. That is, I believe that's the shining one. The other was Sina, and that's the thorny one. Okay. So the one is going to expose him in broad daylight to the enemy. And the other is going to give him splinters the whole way down as he tries to press through the thorn bushes to get to the end. This sounds like a wonderful day. Another day in paradise. Okay. So they're moving forward. Verse 6, Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let's go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised." And he calls them a name that David's going to call them later on when he fights Goliath. He says, "Who are these guys? These are the uncircumcised." He's not talking physiologically about the fact that they're uncircumcised. He's saying these are people who are not in covenant relationship with the one true God of the universe. Who are these people? There's a lot of them, but who are they? So there's only two of us, but who are we? Two circumcised versus an army of uncircumcised. Two who belong to God to a host who don't belong to... Who's got the upper hand here? So his armor bearer doesn't even stop and think about it. His armor bearer says in verse 7, "Do everything that's in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you, heart and soul." Now, Jonathan is laying out a plan, but look at why Jonathan is laying out this plan. He says, "Hey, let's go over to this garrison of the uncircumcised. It may be that the living God, Yahweh," he calls him by name, "will work for us. Because you know as well as I do that nothing can hinder Yahweh from saving by many or by..." There's two of us and God. So it doesn't matter what numbers are on the other side. It's them minus God and us two plus God. Which one is the bigger math? And the guy says, "You're right. You are so right. Let's go." Man, you got to love this. These are two of 600. What if all 600 had this same mindset? This is exciting. And so they go. So Jonathan has this plan. It's stupid. Verse 8, okay, so let's cross over to the men, and then we'll expose ourselves. That's a great idea. We'll expose ourselves to them, and then if they say, "Wait until we come to you," then we're going to stay right where we are, and we'll not go up. But if they say, "Hey, why don't you come up this steep precipice and come all the way up to us," then we'll go up. Because then we'll know that God's given them into our hand, and that's going to be our sign.
Okay.
Right? This is a great battle plan. Let's climb up the face of a rock with them above us, totally exposed. Because if they say, come up, we'll know God's going to give them to us. Good plan, Jonathan. I'm with you, buddy. Okay. So, 11. Both of them showed themselves to the garrison of the Philistines. Philistine says, look, these Hebrews are coming out of their holes. The vermin are starting to climb the rock. Okay. So they're mocking them. Verse 12, the men of the garrison hailed Jonathan and his armor bearer and said, hey, come on up to us. We got something to show you. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come after me. The Lord's given them into the hand of Israel. Now, you don't see it in the text because we don't speak the Hebrew language, but the name Jonathan means the Lord has given. And it's the long spelling of Jonathan that reverberates with this meaning, the Lord has given. And Jonathan basically says, you hear that? They're calling me by name. The Lord's given them in our hand. Let's go. And so the Lord has given them into our hand, and they start to climb up the rock. Verse 13, then Jonathan climbed up on his hands and feet. Both are occupied, right? He's not like climbing up, I am going to get you. You better watch out. He's you know what? Hold on, guys. Just a minute. I'll be right. Hands and feet. He's trying to struggle up this rock. His armor bearer is coming up after him, and they fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer killed after him. And that first strike which Jonathan and his armor bearer made killed about 20 men within, as it were, half a furrow's length. This wasn't a big spot. And 20 men are killed, and there was a panic in the camp, in the field, among all the people. The garrison trembled. Even the different raiding parties trembled. And here's something. The earth quaked. Why did the earth quake? Two men climbing up the hill does not make an earth quake. But two men plus God, who's on the move, God says, something's happening with these two men. Here's my hand that's in it. And it became a very great panic. We don't have a lot of time this morning, and that's okay. But this is a story that's worth breaking down just a little bit. When we come to Jonathan, we see a view of a God, a holy God, the one true God, the living God, and he knows this God to be good. Jonathan is proactive. He's not sitting back waiting for things to happen. He knows what the job of the king is to do. The king is to fight the enemies of God's people. He's to save the people of Israel. That was given right in the description of the king. I believe it's back in chapter 10. This is what the king will do. He'll fight the battles for God's people. He's proactive. Hey, let's go do what we're called to do. Let's go do what we're trained to do. Let's go do what we were called by God, designed by God to do. That we're going to do that. He's proactive. Number two, he draws others in. He says, listen, I'm going to be obedient. I'm going to be faithful. And I'm inviting you to join me in my venture. Wherever this leads, will you join me? It's like when a husband turns to his wife and says, hey, what do you think about us going to seminary?
Bad idea.
Right? He said, hey, listen, I'm following God and God's call on my life. Will you join me? And he said, yeah. I don't want to miss out on this. I want to be a part of that. And he gives the invitation and somebody follows. As the story begins to unfold, he doesn't just invite everybody. The armor bearer says, listen, my heart's your heart, so do whatever your heart says, and I'm with you, heart and soul. And it's rather poetic the way he says it. The armor bearer is a poet of sorts. But immediately the text says, but he didn't tell his dad. He told somebody whose heart would resonate with him, but he didn't tell somebody who has an opposite heart. There's some discernment that he shows here. And as he focuses on what's in front of them, he focuses on the God possibility here. He says, listen, it may be I'm not going to be presumptuous. I'm not going to say, God's going to do this for us. I'm going to say, it may be that God will give us this victory. I don't know. I'm not God, but He is. And I know what position I'm supposed to play. I know that I'm supposed to exercise faith. I know that I have a sword. Will you join me? And I'm going to give, kind of like the Gideon story, I'm looking for a sign. But it's not just make the fleece wet, make the fleece dry. It's going to be a really hard one. God, if you want me to go, will you have them tell me to come? Will you give me an invitation from the enemy to go into enemy territory? Then, God, I know it's from you. And so he makes it rather difficult on purpose so that only God can get the credit. And so he takes, it's not a presumptuous thing, but he's focused on God doing the work if God wants this to be done. And then he's courageous. He goes, hey, let's show ourselves to them. Hey, guys, I want to talk to you.
Why don't you guys come on up here?
Yeah, just a minute. We'll be right up. Okay. He's not an idiot. This is calculated. He's doing this with God. He's doing this through God. He's doing this for God. Not to rescue God. Not that God's got himself in a pickle here. But he's doing this for the name and the glory and the sake of God and the sake of God's people. He's doing this out of faith, not out of stupidity, not out of recklessness, not of carelessness. He knows who he is. He knows that he's the king's son. He knows that he's the next heir. He also knows that it doesn't matter because this dynasty is coming to an end. But as he goes up, he's aware of others and the role that they play within this whole story. Look again at verse 12. Come up here and we'll show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come on up after me, because the Lord has given them into the hand of whom? We're not in this alone, buddy. We wear the name of God. We go as the people of God. We're not heroes. We're just two people that belong to God. We're fighting God's enemies, doing God's work, God's way. And when God does this, he'll get the glory and the people will get the victory. This is God giving them into the hand of our people. We just happen to be two of the people. But he's aware of others. He's not seeking to be a hero. He's just seeking to play his part in God's program, in God's plan. And then we see he's successful. Look down at verse 23. So the Lord saved Israel that day. And the battle passed to Bethaven, beyond Bethaven. In fact, it's 16 miles away they chased these buggers. They're running like deer over hill and dale. Okay. 16 miles. He's successful. Well, basically, the text breaks down in half. That's the first 23 verses. We see this holy God, the one true living God, and he's good, and he's trustworthy, and he's big, and he wants to work on behalf of his people. Enter vision number two. We have a vision of this holy God who's great. This is the vision not of Jonathan, but of Saul. Verse 16, we'll pick it up. The end of the previous story. The watchmen of Saul in Gibeah looked, and behold, the multitude of the Philistines were beginning to disperse here and there. And Saul said to the people who were with him, hey, count and see who's gone from us. When they had counted, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. So Saul said, Ahijah, bring the ark of God here. Now, who's Ahijah? Go back up to verse 3. So there's 600 men with Saul, including Ahijah, the son of Ahitub. So Ahitub is Ichabod's brother. So both Ahitub and Ichabod are sons of Phinehas. who was the son of Eli. Why is that important in this story? That's important because Eli was told by God that your family will no longer be priests. They're done. Your dynasty is done. It's over. Because you have not honored me and my word. You've honored your sons above me. They've been sleeping with the women. They've been lying, cheating, stealing portions that belong to me. And you've done nothing about it. Eli, you've honored man above God. And because of that, your line is done. Phinehas and Eli are both wiped out on the same day, the day that the ark is taken from Israel in battle by the Philistines. And as Phinehas' wife gives birth to a baby, she names him Ichabod, meaning the glory is departed. God is no longer among us. God's not here, and he's not working for his people. He's gone. How do we know that? The ark is gone. The presence of God is gone. The place of meeting with God, it's gone, gone, gone. Saul has just been told, King, you're done. Hey, you know who I'm going to team up with? I'm going to team up with somebody else who feels like an outsider. Poor Ahitub. You know what? We're a bunch of glory departed guys. Hey, let's team up. That sounds like a great idea. We'll be two losers working together on the same team for the glory of God that's gone. Okay, let's see how this works. So back up in 18, so Saul says to Ahijah, hey, bring the ark of God here. Oh, wait a minute. Israel's gotten the ark of God back because the Philistines were plagued by God's presence among them. They sent it back. They didn't want God in their a real God, like a living God who did things. They didn't want him there. So they sent it back. So Saul says, hey, I've got this great idea. We don't have a prophet. Let's bring the ark. Let's bring our lucky rabbit's foot. Let's bring God's presence with us. That's a really good idea, King. You remember what happened last time we did that? They took it. That's brilliant. Way to go. Because the ark of God used to go with them at the time with the people of Israel. Verse 19, so while Saul is talking to the priest, the tumult in the camp of the Philistines increased more and more. Hey, there's like noise happening over there. What's going on? So Saul said to the priest, hey, don't worry about talking to God for me. Just withdraw your... We don't need to know what God says at this point. He didn't say it in so many words, but that's what he's saying. Listen, stop talking to God. I don't care what God says. That's a problem. Okay? Dun, 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 dun. You should hear that music playing in the background at this point in the text. Okay. Verse 20. So Saul and all the people who were with him rallied, and they went into battle. And every Philistine's sword was against us. This is like Gideon number 2, right? This is God doing the same work that we've seen God do back in Judges. So the Philistines' swords are turned against each other. There's very great confusion. In fact, people are coming to join up with Saul and with Jonathan, and the Lord saves the day. Verse 24, then the men of Israel had been pressed hard that day, and Saul laid an oath on the people saying, cursed be the man who eats food until it's evening, and I'm avenged on my enemies. Oh, man. Here's this guy. He's not doing this for Israel. He's not doing this for the glory of the Lord. This is about me. These guys have affronted me. I'm going to get revenge on my enemies. You guys better not eat. We're not eating until they're dead. Okay, let's go, King. Up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. This is hills. That's all this is. 16 miles. They're a little bit hungry by the end. They get on top of one of the hills. There's a forest, probably the hills of Ephraim. Verse 27, Jonathan hadn't heard what happened. So as they enter this forest, there's honey dripping. And so he puts the tip of his staff that was in his hand, and he dipped it in the honeycomb, put it to his mouth, and his eyes became bright. And one of the guys says, hey, you can't do that. Can't do what? You can't eat anything. Your father strictly charged the people, verse 28, with an oath. Cursed be the man who eats food this day. And by the way, we're all hungry. And Jonathan says, My dad, the king, has troubled Israel. He uses a very specific word. It's the same word that Joshua uses of Achan when Achan stole the bar of gold and he took that Babylonian garment and he put it under his tent there at Jericho, and 36 men die because of Achan's pride, arrogance, deception. And Joshua says, you've brought trouble, my friend. You've brought this curse upon Israel. And as the man tells Jonathan, your dad has set a curse upon every man who eats. He says, you know who's cursed Israel? It's my dad. Dad's brought trouble. God is giving us the victory, and dad's making this all about dad. This isn't right. He's not trying to throw his dad under the bus. He's speaking of the king who's not operating under the king, who's putting himself over the king as the ultimate. This is not right. This is not good. He says, verse 30, if the people had eaten freely today the spoil of their enemies. For now, because my dad did this, guess what? He hasn't advanced the cause. The defeat among the Philistines has not been as big as it could. It's not been great. It's not been great. So they struck down the Philistines that day. They press them some 16 miles, and the people are so hungry, they're taking the animals that are left over, and they're slaughtering them. They're eating them just raw. They're not draining the blood. They're famished. They're hungry. It's been a long day. Saul says, no, you can't do that. You're sinning against Yahweh. You're sinning against this holy God. You're sinning against the real living God. He's going to do something if we do this. You can't do that. So he gets a stone, says, bring it here. You've dealt treacherously. Listen, let's cut them up here. Drain the blood. We can eat now. Now that it's dark. So they all start to eat. It's night. And then verse 36, Saul says, hey, let's go after the Philistines. It's nighttime, but we'll keep pressing them. We'll plunder them until it's morning. And the guys say, okay, well, king, we got a little meat in our belly. You do whatever seems good to you. Kind of sounds like Jonathan's armor bearer, right? Say, we're with you, king. Whatever you want to do, you just do what seems good to you. We're with you. The priest says, hey, wait a minute. Let's draw near to God. Verse 37. So Saul said, hey, yeah, let's see what God says about this. Shall I go down to after the Philistines? Will you give him into the hand of Israel? Crickets. God doesn't answer. Saul says, okay, God's mad at us. Come here, all you leaders of the people. Let's see how this sin has arisen today. As the Lord lives, the God who just saved Israel, even if it's Jonathan, my son, he will surely die. God's mad at us. And we're going to get rid of the problem, whatever's standing between us and God. So they do. They bring everybody. Saul puts the army on one side and Saul and Jonathan on the other. And the priest draws the Urim and Thummim, and it shows that it's on the kingly side. And so he says, okay, Jonathan, you or me? And turns out to be Jonathan. He says, what have you done, son? Said, well, Dad, here's what I did. I dipped my staff in some honey, and I ate it, and I was refreshed. Praise God. Kill me. It's your curse. I didn't even know about it. Kill me. And then he said earlier, as the Lord lives, he'll die. Now look at the curse that he calls down, verse 44. He says, Jonathan, God do so to me and more also. You will surely die. This king is so self-inflated and so worried about pleasing God that he's willing to kill his own son. But please God, there's something going on here. Look what happens. Verse 45, the people said to Saul, shall Jonathan die? the one who's worked this great salvation, is it Israel? No king. Way no king. As far from it. In fact, they start to use the king's words. As the Lord lives, king, there will not one hair of his head fall to the ground, king. For this man, king, has worked with God this day, whereas you are working against God, king. I don't think so. And so they save Jonathan from the hand of Saul. What's going on? What's going on with Saul? Saul is an inactive king until push comes to shove, and then he's reactive. He's not about accomplishing God's purpose. He's about sipping on pomegranates under the pomegranate tree. He's about waiting to see what's going to happen. Who's going to do something? I don't want to do anything. This is bigger than me. I don't want this responsibility. We see that he's undiscerning of God's ways. He yokes up with this priest who's on his way out of the priesthood. And when he does do something, he's not necessarily dependent on God so much as he's dependent on the symbols that represent God. He's dependent on the rituals. Hey, let's bring the ark. Because if we got the ark, then we've got God's power. If we've got God's presence, then we've got God's power. Hey, let's talk to God and see what he says. Oh, wait a minute. We don't need to hear from him. I'm not really interested in God. I already see what's happening here. So there's this pragmatism that's focused on circumstances and people. Yeah, I know we're supposed to God right, but this is the circumstances that really matter. And he's very pragmatic in his approach to life. He is presumptuous. You know, I know before I was concerned about getting God's blessing. I'm not worried about, I'm going to have God's blessing. I'm God's king, for crying out loud. Let's go do it. It's a little different attitude than Jonathan. And as he goes, he's self-focused. Listen, you're not eating. You're not eating. These are my enemies. We're going to kill them. Don't you eat. I'm not concerned about you. I'm concerned about my glory. These are my enemies. We're going to chase them down. He's confused. He doesn't have clarity. Okay, let's ask God about this. Wait a minute. God's not answering. What? He's the leader at the front of the pack. What do we do from here? I don't have this game plan. What's our SOP? Where does this fit? I don't know. Rather than being courageous, he's filled. You can watch. Why is he so mad? Why is he so insistent at this point? We've got to find out what sin is in the camp. It wasn't a sin. It was a self-invoked curse. And God is just giving him what he had wanted, what he had requested. God is actually living up to Saul's expectations. Listen, you think I'm a genie that has to be stroked the right way? Okay. You didn't stroke the right way. Find out why, and you'll find that the one that is taken, God hath taken, Jonathan. God hath given is Jonathan, is the one that is taken, Jonathan. This is the one that you are jeopardizing, king, because of your small view of God. Here's what I want us to see. At the end of the whole story, those that he's supposed to be leading, they reject him as leader. And in the end of the day, he's not successful in his venture. It's not as big as it could have been. Yes, Saul and his army join, others join up with them, but because of Saul, it's less successful rather than more successful. These two visions of God. Saul sees a God who's holy, he's real, he's big, but he's mad. He's angry. He's unpredictable. And I have to work hard to get God on my side in order to bless my agenda. Oh, wait a minute. My agenda's being blessed. I don't need God as long as my agenda's being blessed. Now, be careful before you throw Saul under the bus here. Because Saul reveals the tendency in each one of our hearts to do life apart from God. And we do life like this primarily by viewing God only as great. And it's not that God isn't great. He is great. He's the only God that's real. He's the only God that's alive. He's a God who can throw a whole army into confusion. But if I only think of God as great, I'm missing God's glory. Because his glory is not bound up in his greatness. His glory is bound up in his goodness. And Jonathan grabs hold of that. And he says, I know who this God is. This is a God who's faithful. This is a God who can do more than you can ask or think. This is a God who works outside of the box. And this is a God who has graced us to be a part of his story. Let's be a part of it. As we come to this Christmas season, what we find is that we need to ask ourselves, what God do you worship? What God do you worship? Who is God to you? Because at the end of the day, we need to let the one true God shape the realities of our daily life. As we come to Christmas, we find we need to ask ourselves, what does my life say about the God that I worship? You've got some time this time of year. Yes, it's more hectic, it's more busy, but it's also more quiet. So take some time in the quietness of this season and ask, what does my life say about the God that I worship? And how does Jesus inform my understanding of God? Because this self-revealing God wants us to understand who he is through his son Jesus. So how does Jesus inform my understanding of God? How does the God that I worship look like? Sarah brought it to us. One who is meek and lowly of heart. How does this God who's high and lifted up dwell with those who are lowly and contrite in spirit? Does the God that I worship look like Jesus? If so, in what ways? If not, why not? What would it look like if my life looked like Jesus? Because Jesus is the one that has revealed himself to be God. So if you serve the one true God today, you will operate by one of two competing visions of God. Primarily, you'll see him as great. And in your insecurity, you're going to be struggling under this great God who's holy, and you know he's holy, and you have to do everything to please him, because if you don't, he's going to zap you. Or you're going to live in light of a God who loved you so much that he sent his son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. My friend, which God do you serve? Who is God to you? Because God's glory is bound up in his goodness. Let's pray.